Blog Talk Radio.
Here comes the big bad wolf.
Big Bad Wolf by Robodrum. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the program. We had a little bit of a two-week break there. We had to sail around the world and do things like that, you know, and just get out there and see what's happening. And now we're back. And we're going to try to see if we can figure out a name for this show, because I don't think the Christo Radio Show, it sounds that great. It sounds cool to me, but we'll come up with a name, I think. We'll come up with something. Got a great show today. Fantastic guest. You're going to really enjoy listening to him. Let's talk about what's fresh and tasty a little bit out there right now. It's asparagus season, people. Asparagus season. Now's the time. Pick up those asparagus. They're really good grilled. Just throw them on there a few minutes. You can blanch them, grill them, however you want. A little butter, hollandaise, lemon zest, however you want to handle that. Speaking of grilling, next week, important week for Charbroil and all the all-stars out there. I don't know how many of you know I'm a Charbroil all-star, but there's a few of us. And we're going to be meeting in Las Vegas, Nevada for our annual meeting next week. And we're going to be talking about the grilling season. So I'm going to have some exciting news after that to tell everybody about what's going on in the world of grilling and grill terms and Q. That's what the professional people call it, some Q. So we're going to get that going on. I'm going to have to brush up. I'm going to probably have to log on here and find a website with barbecue terms so I make sure I have all those right terms down so that when I'm talking to these other professional barbecue people, I sound like I know what I'm talking about. Otherwise, just trying to keep cooking. Got to feed the kid. Got to do that. So my guest today is a wine guy. And that's going to be exciting because I know a little bit about wine, and I know everyone seems to know what they know about wine, but a real wine guy knows about wine. And he comes from the business side, marketing, and he's been doing wine for a while here, and he's got a lot of insight to this stuff. And I want to welcome Jeremy Kaplan to the program today. Jeremy, you there?
Hello, Christo. Yes, I am.
Hey, how's it going? I've known Jeremy for quite a while now. We've in fact shared a few glasses of wine, and that's always exciting because he knows what he's doing. How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Like you said, it's getting a little wet out there, asparagus season, but after the clouds come the sun.
And that's exactly right. You know, we both live in New York, so we're having the exact same weather right now, and I was kind of thinking how fun it would be had we just maybe met this morning and sat across the table from each other at a cafe and did this radio show like that, just like good old-fashioned radio, people looking at each other. But
well,
if we had all that ambient noise, it wouldn't have been as good. I know all the places that I go to around here are not that quiet.
No, I imagine.
No. So let's see. Tell us about what it is to be a wine steward, a sommelier, wine guy. What's the right thing to call you on this?
Well, I would say I'm simply a very passionate wine lover, and have had a deep interest in wine drinking and otherwise for many, many years, and it probably stems back from my childhood, when not that I was drinking wine, but wine played a very important, place at the table with my father and his friends, and kind of the rituals around, you know, picking wines and opening wines and tasting wines, and it's always been in me, and you know, more or less it's been part of my life socially and more recently from a business point of view.
That's really exciting that you had that influence from your family on that. My family, I probably had the same sort of influence, but growing up, the time that I grew up, my family was, you know, always wanting to have, like, whatever was that new trendy thing. So we had space sticks, and I don't remember if you knew all that stuff that was happening in the 70s. So we probably were the first family that had boxed wine.
Well, we definitely had boxed wine in the house, but it was really... I'll blame my father for prejudicing me towards Burgundy and Bordeaux because, you know, back in the 70s, it's like you really didn't have options like you do today. I mean, those are the big wine-producing regions. You know, California was, you know, really just coming online at the time in terms of distribution, and people who drank wine drank, you know, fine or, you know, French wine mostly.
Right. And I also remember a very popular German wine at that time. I forget what it's called now. I guess
there was a couple. There was Blue Nun.
It was Riesling
and
things
Black
like
Castle.
That.
Black Castle. Oh, Black Tower.
Right.
Black Tower. Well, you know, it's actually very, if you think about it, when we were younger, the wine companies actually did regular advertising and marketing like you see many products today. You know, and Black Tower and Blue Nun were probably two of the bigger brands. Lancers, you know, were probably a big marketer
Blue Nun,
as well.
Yeah, Blue Nun, Lancers, very big.
Yeah.
And then there was, I think, Mogan David was a local, a U.S. brand, right, back in those days that was advertised a lot.
Well, Mogan David is a kosher brand. Mogan David
had crossover. Yeah, it was also considered a religious wine as well, right?
It was for prayer service, but also the initials, they created another product, which some of us may have tried, MD, Mad Dog 2020.
that's interesting. Nobody knew that. I didn't know that.
and they were also the innovators of the screw cap. Everybody gives the Austrians and the Australians and New Zealanders credit for the screw cap, but it was old mug and oven.
Let's talk about that screw cap for a minute there, because I know that screw cap is associated with not a good quality wine, but because of cork and all that sort of thing, the screw cap really, it's okay now, right? Is that what it is? It's okay to get a screw cap now?
It's always been okay. I mean, I think... you know, there's some debate as to how it affects the quality of a wine long term. I'm sure there have been studies on it, but you know, it's long associated with being, you know, cheap wine. But I'm certain I've seen Bordeaux and I've seen Pinot Noirs and I've seen, you know, all variety of wines from different places and around the world. Use screw caps because, first of all, they're cheaper, you know, they're less expensive than cork, which of course is a natural product. It's come from the bark of a cork tree, but also it's actually a better seal than a cork because
make those synthetic corks too.
They make synthetic corks, but that's plastic. But in that case, also it cannot. I mean, when you have a bottle of wine that is corked. It's from a microbe that is contained in wood barrels, even like a cellar or a cork that can impact and spoil a wine. So you won't have that with a screw cap.
But there's another question about the cork, because the cork, the screw cap would not allow any amount of any oxygen or anything whatsoever to get into the wine. So it would seem that the wine would last a lot longer, whereas a cork, as tight as that seal may be and as high quality as that cork could be, still probably, a tiny amount of something that can get in there because it's a cork. Is it sealed so tight that nothing ever gets in, even with a cork?
I mean, as long as the cork stays moist, it remains, expanded and should keep the wine safe. I mean, you can find a 100-year-old bottle of wine, and it's closed.
Right, but the cork is perfectly sealed. Now, that's my next question. So could you have a really delicious 100-year-old bottle of wine that has a screw cap? Would the wine evolve in there, or would it just be hermetically sealed, no longer changing, not doing anything whatsoever, just as fresh as the day you put it in there?
No, absolutely not. No, wine is organic and will decompose just like anything else, a piece of fruit or a piece of meat, regardless.
Even
of
in a completely sealed cap, like a screw cap.
Exactly. It'll turn to vinegar eventually.
Eventually,
but yeah, we don't know what a hundred year screw cap wine tastes like. So
well, we don't know that yet, right?
We'll see.
So you got started with your dad. That's how you got all going on this whole thing. We've talked a little bit about wines and things here, but how can somebody figure out on their own what's the difference between a good wine, a bad wine, fine wine, cheap wine? Is it just personal taste, or are there actual elements?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with personal taste. I mean, you just might not like a certain wine, even though it may be ultra rare or has a 100-point rating or whatever. It's all about personal taste. And when people ask me, how do you learn about wine, or how do you get in the business, or how do I enjoy wine more? It's pretty simple. I mean, I tell them that they should just drink a variety of wine. Don't drink the same wine on a consistent basis.
Mm-hmm.
And also
I like the smoothness of – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying challenge your retailer or your local restaurant to expose you to different and new wines. Walk into a retailer and say, I've got $25 or whatever your budget is. What's the best white or red bottle at that price? And, give me something different and try it. And also, try it with people who also enjoy – wine and like to talk about wine and consider wine. And drinking a bottle of wine by yourself is probably not the best way to learn about wine.
Well, yeah, you're not going to have any clue. You're just going to get more and more drunk, and it's just going to taste delicious no matter what.
Exactly.
I like the smoothness of a Pomerol, for example, myself, and then those, a grittier wine like a Margaux or something. I mean, I call it gritty. What is that, the tannins? When I'm tasting a really smooth wine versus one that seems a little more, for lack of a better word, gritty. Now, people like that.
Yeah.
People like both.
Tannins is what you're probably – I mean, you've thrown out two big wine areas of Bordeaux, Pomerol being, Merlot-based or Merlot-oriented wines, and Margaux being more – Cabernet-oriented wines, and Merlot tends to be fruitier and smoother and lower in tannins than Cabernet, which, again, I'm throwing out words, tends to be more structured and tannic and a little bit more, I'm going to say, rigid, but very capable of providing all that kind of fruitiness and lushness that Merlot provides. But in both instances, you referenced wines that are typically blends, so Merlot, Cabernet. I think a lot of people fear Bordeaux specifically because when it's young, it can be very what was the word you used? Gritty.
Gritty, yeah. You can really taste and feel the tannins.
Yeah, it's very rigid and dry, and sometimes people will say it's a little oaky or woody, and it's not appealing, for some people when it's young. And that's what those tannins are there for a reason. I mean, the tannins are there because that is kind of a natural preservative in the wine and allows the wine to develop over time without just instantly turning into vinegar. Of course, they add sulfites as well.
Do some wines age better than other wines? Would
age?
These two wines that I mentioned typically, you know, seem to have some pretty good shelf life. But wine.
Bordeaux is one of those age-worthy wines. Again, it depends how the winemaker created the wine. I've had a Bordeaux that's as old as I am, so I will not tell you the year, but it was bottled in my birth year and it was quite tasty, quite good.
We can take a wild guess and we can say that it's probably over 21.
Over 21 years old.
Yeah.
And it was delicious. It was exactly over 21 years old.
Every year, like in the Beaujolais Nouveau, what is that? What's a Beaujolais Nouveau? And does a Beaujolais Nouveau turn into an old Beaujolais at some point? Does that change ever? The next year?
It just turns into the old Beaujolais Nouveau. Beaujolais Nouveau is the first official release of wine. Maybe it's from France, but essentially, you know, they pick the grapes in, we'll say September, and they press them and bottle them, and they release it. I believe it's the third Thursday of November, and it became a bit of a marketing media
sensation.
That's
Thanksgiving, isn't the third Thursday of November Thanksgiving?
I think that's the fourth.
The fourth Thursday, okay, so you get a chance to try some Beaujolais Nouveau before you invite your family over.
Thursday. I think it's a Thursday, yeah. The third. We'll just go with it. The third Thursday of November, it's the first release, so it's 2000, so this year you'll have, 2014 juice released, the same, 6 weeks thereabouts after it was bottled, and it's the first bottled wine of the year, and I think it was somebody like Robert Parker who sensationalized it a little bit and discovered who's the major producer of Beaujolais in general, Georges Deboeuf and his bottling, and it became this kind of global sensation because then the Japanese kind of jumped on it and they kind of like one-upped everybody because, that third Thursday of November comes to Japan
to Rene Junot.
Yeah.
That was that ad for a while there.
But
I had the fortunate opportunity to share some wine with you because you've worked around at some fantastic places. And we had a tasty little bottle, and I now had it slipped my mind. What was that one again?
I don't remember the name. The producer I don't recall, but the grape was Petit Verdot. About that bottling was Petit Verdot is typically a blending grape, and in this case it was presented all by itself. It had some bottle age on it. It was a 12-year-old, a 2002 vintage. And it's just a delicious wine, and that's one of those experiences that I recommend to people. It's like look for something that's a little bit, off center when exploring a wine, and that's an example. Not only because of the varietal Petit Verdot, but because it was older, and it's nice to be able to like try a younger vintage versus an older vintage. Try like the same varietal from two different makers or two different regions, like a Sauv Blanc from Loire compared with a Sauv Blanc from New Zealand, and you really start sensing, what wine can be when you do those kind of exercises, and you will be.
Now, what would you pair with something like that? Now, see, I'm often asked for wine pairing suggestions and ideas from people, and I'm not the most experienced wine guy out there, so I can't just go into my little backlog of memory and go, oh, the Petit Verdot, yes, I would pair that with this or pair that with that. I have to taste things, and then I can then draw from the flavors that I'm getting and then make a suggestion on that. It's always awkward and uncomfortable. It's hard for me. When people just say, I have this wine, what would you pair with that? But I couldn't even know. You know, I'd have to taste it, you know?
Yeah, but I mean,
I'm mumbling over here because I don't even know what the question I want to ask. You know,
I guess, how do you pair wine with food?
Well, yeah, and how do you pair wine with food that you haven't tasted?
Yeah, well, I would suggest you start by simply asking, like, what is the origin of the cuisine? If it's Italian, okay, you know, look to an Italian, wine to pair with that food because, you know, here it is, you know, wine is, you know, centuries old. Tradition, you know, people have been making wine for centuries and people have been making food for millennia. And you just ask yourself, it's like, if the dish is Northern Italian, let's look to see what kind of Northern Italian wines are available. And that's kind of a first step that I might take. Where's the food from? Try to get a wine from
right. Well, that's typically the approach that I use there. Like, you know, if it's Northern Italian, go all the way with that. But say, for instance, someone's got like a wine from a California wine, you know, and they want to make some, you know, whatever it is they want to do a Middle Eastern meal or they just want to just ballpark it, you know, pair anything. They've got this delicious wine that they got, you know, and now they want to cook something with it.
California kind of falls a little bit outside of the other wine regions of the world because this is me personally. I feel that California is a little less dependent on things like vintages and the like. But wine, California is where winemakers really can strut their stuff a little bit more than in other regions because there are less regulations about how you can actually make a wine in terms of varietal content and the like versus, you know, different areas of France and Italy and Spain where there are very specific rules about, you know, how much of a certain grape can be in a wine, and if it's labeled as such, it means it's got to be in the barrel for so long. So, yeah, I mean, look, I don't know if there's any wine made in Japan, or I know there's some wine made in Mexico, but, you know, not a lot of it, you know, reaches our shores. And so then you have to, you know, think a little harder about, you know, what is the profile of food and try to find, I say, like-styled wine. So, you know, a Mexican food,
What I'm taking away from this a little bit then is there's no real good taco pairing that you can come up with right off the bat.
A taco can be,
This is an excellent wine for tacos.
Well, I mean, as you know, as a chef, a taco can be it can be fish, it can be meat, it can be vegetarian, mm-hmm. it can have cheese with no, you know, cheese, no cheese. Varying degrees of spiciness, you know, and so
spicy food, I think, doesn't seem to go well with wine for me. It seems like that would be more of a beer thing. You know, you want something cooler, more refreshing, the carbonation. You know, I feel that way like with Indian food. I just can't imagine having a bottle of wine with a really spicy vindaloo. It just seems like you wouldn't experience anything at that point, but.
That's precisely the approach that I would say is, you know, it's a preference thing. You know, a lot of people point to Rieslings as because of its sweetness and in some instances high acidity, you know, can counterbalance spicy foods, whether it's Mexican or Indian or Chinese. But when I go to spicy food, I tend to go towards sparkling wine. You know, and you mentioned
sparkling
beer
wine,
as an option, but I think sparkling wine with a touch of sweetness, you know, is a good idea. you know, sparkling Riesling, for example.
Pretty good. I didn't even think of that. What's the best bottle of wine you've ever had? Well, the most memorable bottle all at once. It was a moonlight night. You were on the banks of the sea.
I'd say, you know, the most memorable bottles I've had are the ones that have happened. They weren't at fancy restaurants or, you know, at elaborate dinners. They tended to be the bottles that were surprises. A friend of the family showed up at the house once when I was younger after playing tennis with two bottles of DRC, which is, you know, one of the most exquisite Burgundies, you know, produced on this earth. And I don't remember the specific bottlings, but, you know, here's a bottle that's worth, you know, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, and we're drinking it after tennis, you know. So I remember that bottle, and it was very good, you know. Or, you know, I'll mention, you know, a bottle of a wine that I drank by myself on my honeymoon, you know, in St. Bart's, and I just remember just savoring the bottle, you know, drop by drop, and in a beautiful setting, and, you know, it was just exquisite, you know. And so sometimes it's those bottles that you're, you know, like I said, you wasn't a fancy meal, or it was just kind of an interesting setting and an interesting memory. And that's what sometimes makes those bottles the best bottles you've ever had.
For myself, it was a Saint Emilion Grand Cru Classe. That it was probably 1989 or something like that. And I got it for $8.99 at a wine store here in New York. I'm convinced it was mispriced. I bought one. It was so delicious, I couldn't believe it. So I bought three more, and I should have bought all of them. Because when I went back after that, they had been marked back to, I guess, the price they should have been.
Those were one of those genius opportunities. You were lucky.
I was very lucky, and you know, you see an $8.99 bottle, and it says, you know, it's Grand Cru Classe, all these things. You're thinking, what happened? You know, did they leave it in the warehouse too long, or is there something wrong with this? But I think they mispriced it.
They mispriced it.
And it was a delicious, that was probably the best thing I've ever had. I've had some pretty good wines after that, but, and I'm such a frugal monger, you know, price just sticks out in my head, and having such a wonderful wine for such a good price, that the $1,000 bottle of wine, the $150 bottle of wine, the $200 bottle of wine, those, for some reason, they were delicious, they just didn't register.
Yeah.
So it's funny to me, I'm a bargain hunter.
I love the bargain.
Well, you know, we've got a couple minutes left. A lot of good information here. Just to wrap it up, what would you recommend to people who want to get started doing this with wine? Sit down with someone else.
In terms of getting into the business or just learning?
Getting into the business, learning about wine. Getting into the business is probably a bigger step. I think more just for people who want to just take that step and go beyond what they've been buying at their local supermarket, even, you know, just going into a wine store, talk to the wine guy, tell him what you're interested in, tell him what your flavors are, right?
Well, I'd say reading is a good idea. I mean, whether it's Wine Spectator or just the wine column in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, just try to, you know, read about wine on a regular basis. And often those articles will reference wines and what they taste like, and you'll learn about where the wines come from, et cetera. So I say, you know, try to make wine reading a regular part of your self-education. But as I said before, you know, challenge your retailer and challenge your local wine bar or restaurant to give you something new and different for the price point that
and
makes
I think
you
that's
feel
the key,
comfortable.
That's the key piece of information right there, because don't be afraid to ask these people questions. You might feel that you're asking some sort of a silly question. Wine people like to talk. They like to tell you about stuff, you know, so they're going to want to inform you, right? I mean, that's just the way it is.
But also challenge yourself and try that Petit Verdot. try that, you know, that sparkling Riesling, try that, whatever it is, you know, just don't drink the same wine every time you sit down to have a drink of wine.
And that's, we'll end on that note. Don't drink the same wine every time. Thanks a lot, Jeremy. You got this 30 minutes.
Thank you, Crystal.
Thanks so much. And hey, everybody, leave comments when you see the various posts. Let's see if we can come up with a name for this show. I guess we're going to just wrap it up here, a little Big Bad Wolf, and out we go.
Take care.
Take care. Thanks.